This edition of the Monocle Arts Review was first broadcast on the 12th of June 2015 on Monocle 24. Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Gillian DeBias. Now today I'm joined by critic Karen Krzanovich to get to grips with a trio of films, a blockbuster, a re-release and a documentary. We'll decide whether the fourth Jurassic Park installment, Jurassic World, lives up to its 1993 original. We'll revisit Marilyn Monroe and Clark Gable in The Misfits as it gets re-released into cinemas. And we'll take a sobering look at Joshua Oppenheimer's latest documentary on the Indonesian death squads in the 1960s, The Look of Silence. That's all to come right here on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. Now, a very warm welcome to the show, Karen. We're going to begin with an almighty roar as Jurassic World hit cinemas worldwide this week. It's been 14 years since the last Jurassic film, and this fourth installment has been highly anticipated by fans for quite some time. Karen, does it live up to expectations?
Well, it's very difficult to say anything bad about Jurassic World because we're in love with the dinosaurs. It was such a revolutionary, the first film anyway, it was such a revolutionary blockbuster. It was unique in entertainment values. To see Sam Neill running through a herd of dinosaur was just amazing. And it was breathtaking. It was scary. And the way it was set up was also frightening. It's got some real iconic moments. Now, Jurassic World has only one of the original cast members in it. It's almost a reboot, really. But we've gone back to the theme park, which of course was closed. It is now in, I think probably always was in Costa Rica, but it's now on it's all been revamped. So children can come and ride dinosaurs. They can hug and squeeze baby dinosaurs. But there's also something else afoot. We've seen all the dinosaurs, although 18 different ones were used in this film. So they've decided, the people that have brought the corporate entities who have brought this this theme park back online, they've decided to hybrid the Tyrannosaurus Rex with something else, and they won't tell us what else. And of course, mayhem ensues.
Well, when you go into that darkened cinema, you always know that there's going to be a great amount of inventiveness. So let's try and hear a little bit of the atmosphere with a clip now. And this is Chris Pratt as Owen in the enclosure with the dinosaurs.
Owen, no! Oh, no, hold your fire! Hold your fire, do not fire! Put 12 amps in these animals, they're never gonna trust me again. Blue, stand down. Stand down. Hey, hey! What did I just say? Delta, I see you. Back up.
The sound of Jurassic World. Now, what kind of world has the director created this time around?
It's quite tropical. I mean, it's tropical, it's dangerous, it's scary. It's a lot more high tech than what we saw before. For example, if you want to take a ride through a forest or a field of dinosaurs, you're in a Perspex globe that rolls along by itself, which is wonderful. And two of the young protagonists, two brothers, get stuck out there and they decide they're just going to drive off. Meanwhile, Bryce Dallas Howard, that is right, who plays their aunt. She is sort of, she's the operations manager. She's supposed to be keeping an eye on them and everything else in the park when this hybrid dinosaur starts to cause problems. And it is ultra smart, of course. Now, she has also had a romantic interlude of some kind with Owen. And it's interesting that Bryce Dallas Howard is, you know, very, very efficient. But Owen is kind of a throwback to sort of the Romancing the Stone. You know, he's a real guy. And it's actually a surprisingly sort of sexy, and a few swear words were in it. And I was thinking, for a children's program, I'm not so sure about this. But it does bring a new interest to dinosaurs, and the special effects and the sound design, as you've just heard, is amazing.
For all the people who literally are devotees of the Jurassic franchise, part of the appeal was the cast.
Yes.
And so we have a new cast of characters. Do you feel a sense of nostalgia, or does a new cast run with the task?
I think that the new cast works perfectly well. I mean, as I said, I think it's B.D. Wong. B.D. Wong is the only one that's left over from Jurassic Park. But we've got Irfan Khan, who's really one of the corporate investors. And he's not immoral. He's quite moral, actually. And I think that's one of the things that you expect with Jurassic Park, the Jurassic Park franchise, is that the good people are interested in creating the dinosaurs and that bad people just want to make money off of them. And they want them to kill people and they want to kill the dinosaurs. And there's three things that I've noticed, actually two things, that if you're fat in Jurassic World, you get some bad things happen. And also, if you're from a tea-drinking nation, bad things happen. So I'm just warning you now. The Brits, Indians, and the Chinese really don't come off very well. But it is an international cast. In fact, they got Omar Sy here, who's a wonderful French actor. He's terrific. And the performances are very exciting.
Is it scary?
Yes. The last third is quite scary, and it's quite surprising. I'm not going to say any spoilers, but it's quite fun. And also, I was sitting between two people who are making terrible comments like, not enough children are being killed, which I thought was a bit wrong. But nevertheless, I mean, it's actually quite funny because you don't see a lot of the dinosaurs, and you also, the terrible deaths that, of course, we expect when you have dinosaurs that are hungry, you don't actually see or hear, they're there, and then 1 minute they're not there. So it's not, like, icky.
Okay, so, well, yeah. Then for those of you who like to mix a little fear with your entertainment, then Jurassic World is the one for you. Well, that's our blockbuster for the week. Let's move on now to a classic that's getting re-released. The Misfits is the last film that both Marilyn Monroe and Clark Gable were to make. Gable died 2 weeks after the film wrapped, and Monroe a year and a half later. The Misfits tells the story of a recently divorced woman who befriends an aging cowboy. It wasn't commercially successful when it was released in 1961, but it's a favorite with critics the world over. Karen, this is widely regarded as some of the two actors' best works, but the behind the scenes on set were quite troubled, were they not?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's been renewed interest in this movie because Marilyn would have been 89. And also, this was a transformational film for her. It really was. But she was this film was written for her by Arthur Miller, her prize-winning husband, very intellectual. And in fact, when they first got married, one of the tabloids said, "Egghead weds hourglass." You know, would they get away with that these days? They probably would. But their marriage began to fall apart because, of course, it takes a long time to get a film made. And despite the best efforts of John Huston, who actually spent quite a great deal of time offset gambling and coming in late, and Clark Gable working very, very hard, and perhaps too hard, they were saying it was too strenuous for him, Arthur Miller was rewriting, now this is according to legend, was rewriting the script every night for Marilyn, knowing that she had trouble memorizing lines anyway, but also using actual phraseology from her previous divorce. So it was a real emotional challenge for her.
But it's interesting because I think part of the appeal to her marrying Miller was she wanted to get away from being thought of as a sex bomb.
Absolutely.
And yet he writes this film for her, which is all about her being a sex bomb divided by these, you know, three cowboys. That also must have really kind of troubled her.
She is very sexy in this, but she's also this sort of life force, you know, that's a nice way of putting it, I suppose. But she's very, very appealing. But you're right, she is almost like a little piece of meat thrown up between the three men, as there are three men involved. Yes, she did have problems with this, but you can see, and this is why The Misfits is really one of my choices for this week, you can really see her emerging as an actress. Now, she was 36, I believe, at this time. And Hollywood would not embrace her much longer as a sex symbol. So she was trying to transform her life, and you can see it right here.
Well, let's have a listen right here. This is a clip of Marilyn and Clark as Rosalind and Gay.
You're a real beautiful woman. It's almost kind of an honor sitting next to you. You just shine in my eyes. That's my true feeling, Rosalind. What makes you so sad? I think you're the saddest girl I ever met.
You're the first man that ever said that. I'm usually told how happy I am.
That's because you make a man feel happy.
And that was a clip from the original of The Misfits. Now, you know, she always plays such vulnerable characters. And on the set of this film, she did spend a lot of time rehearsing with Paula Strasberg, her mm-hmm. coach, because she so desperately wanted to be accepted as an actress, didn't she?
She really wanted respect. She really did. And yet she was gifted. She was very gifted and also perfectionist, which I think is heartbreaking. And listening to that scene, actually, that's a really excruciating scene because the movie is actually quite dated. This one meant when men could sort of paw women, it was okay, you know. And there is a couple, there are a couple of scenes where you just think, oh, you know, we wouldn't have that, you know. But that's how it was in the 60s. So, yeah, this is her yearning for credibility.
It's been released partly, you know, as part of the British Film Institute's mm-hmm. tribute to Marilyn Monroe. But it will go worldwide. It has been viewed and viewed and viewed again worldwide. What is the international appeal? Why does it get almost more popular as the years go on?
You mean this particular film or
Marilyn
in general?
Yeah, The Misfits.
Because it's heartbreaking, and also there is, and with the stars aside, it's black and white, which of course some people be put off by, but there are some incredible stunts with wild horses. And that sounds really weird, but they will break your heart because this is how they used to hunt horses back in the day. And it is, again, it's almost like Lonely Are the Brave, where we see the demise of the American dream. And I think there's just so many elements of this film that appeal across the board. But you will come away feeling uplifted, but also deeply saddened.
Well, The Misfits has just been re-released in the UK and France. And for those of you who have never seen the film or are now tempted to watch it again, you can, of course, always find it on DVD. We're going to end the show now with Joshua Oppenheimer's powerful new documentary, The Look of Silence. This is a companion film to his Oscar-nominated 2012 film, The Act of Killing, which investigates the 1965 Indonesian genocide. This new film follows a family of survivors who have discovered how their son was killed and by whom. The younger son is an optometrist who confronts his brother's killers whilst testing their eyes. A harrowing tale, Karen, but an interesting treatment of the story.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I found The Act of Killing very difficult to watch, and I think it was supposed to be difficult because it's unimaginable what has been happening in Indonesia and probably other countries. And that's what even makes me even more upset. But with The Look of Silence, Joshua Oppenheimer is now he made this. He went back to talk to the perpetrators of the genocide, almost genocide, really, in Indonesia before the Act of Killing had come out. So they knew he made a movie, but they weren't really quite sure. So he went along with this optometrist, Addy. He was a young man. He was actually born at the time of when the anti-communist purge was on. And this was Addy's idea to go around and test the perpetrator's eyes and to say very gently to them, would you like to admit your guilt? Because he thinks that, because these people are boasting about killing his brother and other people. In fact, the film opens with him watching a man describing exactly how his brother was killed. And it wasn't nice. It wasn't a nice death.
It is extraordinary. You forget that this isn't a piece of drama and fiction because the premise of an optometrist, you know, breaking the silence and being witness to these secrets is quite heady. But this is a documentary. He was not optometrist.
He definitely was. He went around and he said, I will test your eyes and you'll get a free pair of glasses if you let me talk to you. And at first, Oppenheimer thought this was too dangerous. We can't do this. But Addy really wanted to do it. He'd suggested it. And he went very, very gently. And it's terrifying. It's terrifying, the different kinds of reactions. But also, Addy feels and believed, and I think this is quite probably culturally, I don't know if I would think this way, but maybe culturally ingrained, that these people are boasting because they are burdened with guilt, which is a nice way of putting it. But there's also the sound design. Now, this is a documentary, but that does not mean it's not well crafted. It is very carefully crafted with 16 different layers of sound over it to
meaning
try
what,
and evoke
like the sound, meaning
crickets and insects, to give you the sound of the look of silence. That's what he's trying to evoke, this feeling of ghosts and what is not said.
We have a tiny bit of the soundtrack now, which we might play in.
Dari kepiye mak perasaan mama tinggal cerok di antara pembunuh anak imam.
People also talk about the cinematography in this film, and it's a little uncomfortable to have something so beautiful about something so brutal.
Well, you, by the way, that I believe that, not that my Indonesian is great, but I think that was, how do you feel when you hear about your son, when you're around with people that have killed your son, and this woman just sitting there. Yes, it is beautiful, but it has to be beautiful because the topic is almost unbelievably ugly. You have to... You need something to contemplate after you hear these horrific stories. It's almost as if he's giving us a little break. Here's a beautiful picture of a truck going down the road, and here's some lovely crickets to listen to, and here's some nice trees, and it's very calming. And in a way, it is more alarming than fast edits and loud noises. Mm-hmm.
Film is such a powerful medium, and I wonder if you feel a little bit uncomfortable that these killers, the subject of this documentary, are turned into celebrities.
Yes. Well, I mean, they've already celebrities, but because they've done what the government wanted them to do. And there was a lot of strange footage that slave labor was used and American companies came in. So there's a lot in this documentary. But Oppenheimer has said that he thinks that this is actually healing the country, because after the act of killing came out, at least the government acknowledged that this was a crime against humanity. So film can actually heal wounds, or at least we hope it can start.
Well, since its premiere at the Venice Film Festival, The Look of Silence is continuing to roll out on the festival circuit with screenings at the Biograph Film Festival in Italy and the AFI Docs Festival in the US. Having opened in the UK already, the film will be released in Japan and North America next month. And do make sure to tune into Culture with Robert Bound this coming Monday at 1900 hours London time for a special interview with the director, Joshua Oppenheimer, about the making of the film. And that brings us to the end of today's show. Karen Krasanovich, thank you as ever for joining us in studio. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Gillian DeBias. My producer was Holly Fisher, and my researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Thanks very much for listening.